now I want to act upon this belief. I have faith in the Almighty, and now I wish to see the results and the fruits of this Tawheed. And I can do that by worshipping, by expressing my devout devotion to the Almighty. I wish to show that I have submitted and done my taslim to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yes, ta'a and obedience is one thing, but ibadah and worship is something else. Innani ana Allah la ilaha illa ana fa'budni. Again, the whole message of our anbiya, all of them, was to bring about people to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to worship Him. The reason why we were created was to worship the Almighty. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Alhamdulillah, no matter what comes my way. Alhamdulillah, my heart will thank and praise. And every time I feel it down or out of place, alhamdulillah, everything is gonna be okay. This dunya can deceive me when nothing ever goes as planned. And when I can't remember, my heart will surely understand. I ask Allah to guide me. I'm starving for His mercy, so I'll thank Him for whatever I have.
Washington's own terrorist.
This is Miami, an international metropolis known for its beaches, tourism. Miami is also the capital of the Cuban exile community. And Spanish is more common than English as the trading language. The Cuban exiles have historically juxtaposed Miami's capitalist bonanza to the financial hardships of communist Cuba, located only 90 miles away. But not many will associate present-day Miami to the biggest terrorist center in the whole world, which is how this city was described during the 1960s. Up to the present day, these Miami-based Cuban exiles still seem to get their way with the U.S. government, no matter what they do.
The United States likes to protect its own, Washington's own terrorists.
In 1961, a paramilitary group of Cuban exiles, funded and trained by the CIA, set off from Florida with the aim of invading Cuba and toppling the socialist government. After disembarking at the Bay of Pigs, they were defeated by the Cuban forces under the command of Fidel Castro. The survivors of this failed invasion returned to the U.S., where many of them regrouped into different armed militias, all of them based around Miami. One such group that has been active for almost five decades is Alpha 66, and veteran fighters Ociel Gonzalez and Reynold Rodriguez are two of its founders. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., a lawyer specialized in human rights has been coming at odds with most of his fellow Cuban Americans and the U.S. establishment. For years, Jose Portilla has been fighting against the U.S. government's tolerance of fringe groups, such as Alpha 66.
These folks train openly in southern Florida in the Everglades. They dress up like Rambo in their camouflage. They crawl around in the swamps before television cameras to show how they're training to defeat the government of Raul Castro and how they were planning to blow up installations in Cuba.
There's a law called the Neutrality Act that prohibits people from using the United States shores, United States territory, to train or carry out acts of sabotage and subversion against other countries. It's a law that was passed by Congress because the business of making war is the business of government, not fringe groups.
After years of transmitting from a van with heavily armed guards as lookouts, the U.S. authorities eventually arrested a member of Alpha 66 for illegal radio broadcasts, but very quickly let him go and returned their van, although without the radio transmitter. Many of the weapons that have been seized from Alpha 66 are cataloged as combat weapons, intended exclusively for military use.
Sometimes the acts of terrorism are so blatant, they have to do something, otherwise the American people won't understand why you're protecting these guys. But what happens is you don't prosecute him zealously, or you make sure that he doesn't get a lot of time.
Santiago Alvarez, a millionaire Miami-based property developer, is another member of Alpha 66. The FBI also found a silencer and a grenade launcher. Instead of charging him with providing material support to terrorist activities, a crime which carries a sentence of 15 years to life, Santiago Alvarez only had to plead guilty to one count of illegal weapons possession. Raul Alzaga migrated to the United States from Cuba when he was only 6 years old. After radically changing his posture towards Cuba and relocating to Puerto Rico, he teamed up with his old friend Carlos Muñiz, and together they started Viajes Varadero, a tourist agency that promoted what up to then had been banned by law, the travel of Cuban exiles back to the island. Alpha 66 and its associates were to, once again, play an active role in Raul's life. The murder of Carlos Muñiz was orchestrated and carried out by a group of Cuban right-wing extremists based in Puerto Rico, one of which is widely suspected to be Julito Labatut, seen here on a TV interview from 2001. Another high-profile extremist is suspected to have engineered the murder together with Labatut. Reynold Rodriguez is regarded as the strongman amongst the veteran anti-Castro fighters based in Miami. According to him, the accusations of murder that Raul and others make against him come from a certain threat he publicly made after being himself the victim of an attack. Back in Puerto Rico, the attack on the travel industry wasn't to cease with the murder of Muñiz. Also based in Miami, Antonio Veciana is another founding member of Alpha 66. He shares more than just a friendship with Reynold Rodriguez. The likely reasons for the attempt on Antonio Veciana's life are the many plots to murder Fidel Castro, which he directed. Just as all the other members of Alpha 66 we have seen so far, Antonio Veciana also used to be on the payroll of the CIA. After fleeing Cuba following his first attempt on Castro's life, Antonio Veciana continued working for the CIA in South America. Eventually, in 1971, he heard of Castro's planned visit to Chile, and with the help of his CIA binders, plotted another attempt on his arch enemy. Back in Santiago Alvarez's luxury Miami mansion, he and his fellow Alpha 66 comrades-in-arms are reminiscing of the old times. Together, they used to steal weapons from the U.S. Army and use them to carry out commando attacks on the Cuban shoreline. The MRR was a subversive group financed and armed by the CIA. It operated from Central America, carrying out bombings, arson attacks, and acts of sabotage against Cuba. However, according to the Cuban government, these were not Alvarez's only civilian casualties. Cuban authorities allege that Alvarez was on board a motorboat that shelled the shoreline of a Cuban fishing village in 1971, killing two men and wounding four others, including two young girls. Santiago and his friends feel in a celebratory mood as Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's president and the man whom they see as Fidel Castro's greatest friend, has just passed away. Meanwhile, in the other side of town, Cuban journalist Max Lesnik and a group of his friends watch with sadness the funeral of Venezuela's commander-in-chief. Max has lived in Miami since fleeing Cuba in 1961. He was opposed to communism in Cuba, but has also voiced praise for Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez caring for the impoverished classes.
Viva Chavez!
Through a Varieties magazine he used to have during the 1970s, Max condemned the violent acts of the anti-Castro extreme right. Max's unwavering stance against terrorism was manifested more firmly when, in 1976, a Cuban commercial airline was blown into pieces, killing all passengers on board. For decades, the coasts of Florida have been a safe haven for CIA-trained terrorists capable of the most barbaric acts. These acts of terror not only took place in foreign lands, but also on U.S. soil. Behind the wave of terror were the anti-Castro extremists, and above all of them was one man in particular. Lawyer Jose Portierra has incessantly fought to bring Luis Posada to justice for masterminding the bombing of the Cuban airliner. Jose Portierra believes the amount of evidence against Luis Posada is overwhelming.
We have confessions by his co-conspirators, Hernán Ricardo and Freddy Lugo, who finger Posada Carriles.
Hernán Ricardo and Freddy Lugo are two Venezuelan mercenaries who were the actual perpetrators of the crime.
The phone calls that were made by Hernán Ricardo to Caracas, to Posada Carriles' office, looking for Posada Carriles and to Orlando Bosch moments after the downing of the plane.
Lugo and Ricardo confessed to being hired by CORU, which they accurately describe as the anti-Castro group headed by Luis Posada and Orlando Bosch, another former employee of the CIA. Soon after the attack, Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, was quick to deny any U.S. involvement in the bombings.
The United States had absolutely nothing to do with any of its organs in the explosion of the Cuban airliner.
Kissinger then went a bit further and stated that no one in contact with the American government has had anything to do with the bombing. However, 20 years after the downing of the Cubana airliner, new evidence related to this incident was to surface.
Declassified documents of the United States government, where there is an admission by Posada Carriles days before the downing of the plane that he had the intention to blow up a plane and that Orlando Bosch had all the details.
Contrary to what Henry Kissinger had declared, the CIA had known about the plans to bomb the plane as far as 3 months before the incident. The agency had sent a memo with the subject possible plans of Cuban exile extremists to blow up a Cubana airliner to top officials at the White House, the FBI, and the Pentagon. Just over 3 months after the CIA's memo regarding the imminent terrorist attack, ex-CIA agent Luis Posada orchestrated the bombing of Cubana Flight 455. Although for more practical reasons, Luis Posada's former associate also condemns the barbarity of the airliner bombing. Antonio Veciana's comrades from Alpha 66 still deny Posada's involvement in the bombing. However, after many years of discreet silence, Antonio Veciana now told us some details never before disclosed, revealing even more evidence of Posada's guilt. After Venezuelan bombers Ricardo and Lugo confessed to the crime, they implicated Luis Posada and Orlando Bosch. The four of them were jailed in Venezuela, from where they had planned the attack. While Orlando Bosch was being interrogated in Caracas, back in the United States, Antonio Veciana was summoned by the U.S. Congress. As Veciana was to discover, the concerns from the U.S. Congress were rather more related to financial issues than to the loss of human lives. Despite his obvious involvement in the bombing, in 1987, a pro-American Venezuelan government set Orlando Bosch free. 2 years earlier, Luis Posada had already managed to escape from prison. Bosch went straight to Miami, where he was arrested again for pending crimes related to an attack on a Polish ship.
Convicted of firing a bazooka at a Polish ship in the Miami harbor.
But instead of getting the treatment of a murderer convicted for acts of terrorism, Orlando Bosch was the beneficiary of a huge campaign to free him.
Matters in the future.
Ileana Ross is a Republican congresswoman who, back in the late 1980s, had employed Jeb Bush, the son of the then President George Bush Sr., as her campaign manager. Ross and Jeb Bush thought that if she managed to free Orlando Bosch, she would be rewarded with millions of votes from Florida residents. So, with Jeb Bush lobbying with his father, twice convicted terrorist Orlando Bosch was freed from jail. In 2011, Orlando Bosch died of natural causes while enjoying the freedom guaranteed to him by the Bush family. In Miami, public demonstrations of mourning were held for the man responsible for more than 100 murders.
Murió terrorista porque siempre fue un terrorista.
In 1985, he escaped from a prison. He bribed his way out with the help of friends in Miami and about $55,000, and he fled the country of Venezuela. Wanted for 73 counts of first-degree murder, manages to land a job in a matter of days, earning in 1985 over $100,000 a year, working for the Central Intelligence Agency in the Iran-Contra scandal in El Salvador. I would think he has good friends in high places.
But his influential friends from Washington couldn't protect him when, in 1990, gunmen presumably sent by Fidel Castro got hold of him in Guatemala City. He miraculously survived the 12 shots he received, but a bullet in the jaw left him with a speech impediment and a disfigured face. However, that was not to stop Luis Posada's campaign of terror.
The Soviet Union and its allies had collapsed, and that meant the collapse of the Cuban economy because they were Cuba's trading partners, and there is a blockade against Cuba that has been going on since the Kennedy administration. So Cuba turned to tourism to try to bring dollars into the island. And the thinking of these terrorists was, what if we set off bombs at the most famous hotels and restaurants in Cuba, that'll scare off tourism.
With the help of dollars from the Cuban-American Miami extremists, Luis Posada recruited mercenaries and began a bombing campaign in Cuba that, amongst other things, was to claim the life of an Italian tourist.
Fabio Di Chelmo, in 1998 in Havana, was just an Italian businessman drinking coffee with his friends, and a bomb blew up in an ashtray near the counter, and a piece of shrapnel cut his jugular vein and killed him almost immediately.
One of the bombers working with Luis Posada, a Salvadoran mercenary, was captured by Cuban authorities, who filmed his reenacting of the crime. The captured bomber confessed to receiving money from Posada to carry out the attacks in Cuba, while the latter, with a concealed face, boasted on Miami television about his links to the crime. To add insult to injury, Posada then explicitly expressed his lack of remorse for the murder of the Italian tourist on a recorded telephone interview. But attacking tourist destinations was not an original idea of Luis Posada. During 1994 and 1995, Alpha 66 carried out machine gun attacks against Cuban tourist hotels. According to Alpha 66's own website, in recent years, the emphasis has been in calling the attention to the tourists who are cooperating with the Cuban regime. Cells of Alpha 66 have sabotaged tourist attractions in other places. With such precedent, it's little wonder that the members of Alpha 66 feel rather sympathetic to Luis Posada and his exploits. After carrying out his bombing campaign, Luis Posada went on to try to assassinate Fidel Castro during a visit of the Cuban leader to Panama in year 2000. Seen here in a surveillance video taken by Cuban intelligence in Panama City, Posada and three accomplices were arrested in possession of C4 explosives, and the attack on Castro was foiled. The evidence against Posada and the other three would-be assassins was so overwhelming that not even Alvarez's substantial resources could spare them from prison. Only 4 months after being imprisoned, the four Cubans who had tried to murder Castro were freed by a pardon from Panamanian President Mireya Moscoso. Right after freeing the extremists, she left a message on the answering machine of the then U.S. ambassador in Panama.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The availability of free street parking can also inflate car ownership. A study of the four biggest cities in the Netherlands found that higher parking costs in city centers accounted for about 30% of the lower car ownership rates compared with the outskirts. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Zhao Zhi Lim. The piece is titled "The Hidden Climate Costs of America's Free Parking Spaces." Street space occupied by parked cars may not seem like much, but it adds up. The United States has an estimated 3.4 spaces for every car. According to one estimate, in New York City, the amount of road space reserved for parking is roughly the size of 12 Central Parks. And most of the city's 4 million street parking spots are free. Donald Shoup, a transportation professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, says, "The curb lane is some of the most valuable land on Earth," adding, "I think that's our biggest mistake, to take some of the most valuable land on Earth and give it away free to cars." Street parking doesn't just take away space, it can inform how people get around. Daniel Firth, transportation director at C40 Cities, a network of more than 100 cities around the world with ambitious climate goals, says, "Parking is one of the things that has a really powerful impact on people's decisions whether to drive or not." Donald Shoup and others have found that underpriced street parking keeps people driving in cities, even in those that have good alternative transportation options. More people driving means more city traffic, increasing congestion, and pumping out pollution. But cities that want to price or even convert free street parking face obstacles, and not just from drivers. Most cities don't have enough information about how their curbs are used, making it difficult to decide how to manage this valuable space. Companies offering curb management technology have sprung up to try to fill this gap, with promises to help cities reclaim their curbs. Their digital platforms map parking spaces and curb use around cities. Peter Richards, who leads the development of software product Curb IQ at Canadian consultancy company IBI Group, says having the information in one place and being able to visualize curb spaces on a map is vital. Peter Richards says Curb IQ was born out of years of working on parking strategy projects for cities and realizing cities don't have easily accessible digitized information about their curbs. The end game is to help cities reduce car numbers, along with congestion, noise, and pollution, while making better use of spaces and still meeting people's mobility needs. Donald Shoup, who has led surveys of drivers stopping at city traffic lights to ask them why they are driving, said the prospect of snagging a free or cheap street parking spot compared with an expensive off-street spot keeps drivers cruising. In one instance, 68% of the drivers surveyed in a Los Angeles neighborhood were cruising for a parking spot. The availability of free street parking can also inflate car ownership. A study of four biggest cities in the Netherlands found that higher parking costs in city centers accounted for about 30% of the lower car ownership rates compared with the outskirts. Jacob Baskin, the co-founder of Coord, a New York City-based curb management company, said, "You can reduce car ownership quite significantly by making parking more expensive or by reducing the amount of parking you build. And there is data to show city residents may prefer less parking." Donald Shoup said a survey of London residents found that their top choice for using curb space was to plant trees. Parking ranked fifth. One of the first steps that Curb IQ and Coord do for cities is to lay out digitized information about the existing permitted use of curbs on a map, usually by driving around and using machine vision software to capture the street signs, forming the foundation of a city's curb management platform. Peter Richards says it's a lot easier to make decisions and plan when you have all this information together. Maya Bendroor, who leads transportation at the World Economic Forum, says during COVID, the political barriers to reclaiming curb spaces from free street parking were removed. Commuters started working from home, freeing up parking spaces. Meanwhile, restaurants and other businesses needed outdoor space in cities. She said that allowed curb management companies to really grow during the coronavirus pandemic. Jacob Baskin, the co-founder of Coord, says cities use Coord's platform to figure out, here's where we have space where we think we can repurpose to either be restaurant seating or pick up and drop off space in ways that will benefit the city. During the summer of 2021, IBI staff used Curb IB software to help the City of Toronto launch its Cafe TO program that allowed restaurants to set up patios and appropriate curb space, identifying those far enough away from fire hydrants, traffic intersections, or transit stops. Peter Richards says having a map of curb spaces and their regulations helped the city move quickly. CoOrd is working with cities such as Aspen, Colorado, to designate smart zones. Curb spaces reserved for gig and delivery drivers to book through an app when they are approaching their destinations. Home deliveries and ride shares continue to rise in popularity, and drivers need temporary curb space to complete pickups and drop-offs safely. When free street parking dominates, drivers either have to circle around the neighborhood looking for parking space or simply double park, holding up traffic, increasing pollution, and endangering pedestrians and bicyclists. Baskin says double parking can really snag up traffic. He adds, people hate it. Maya Bendroor says smart zones could help cities manage the competition for curb space among these drivers and ease congestion from their cruising. Both CoOrd and Curb IQ are working to quantify the tangible benefits, such as reduced emissions. Firth says many businesses will reflexively object to the conversion of free parking spaces in front of their shops, fearing a loss of customers. But often, business owners overestimate how much their customers are arriving by cars. A study in Seattle found that sales revenue increased 5.4% among downtown restaurants after paid parking hours were extended, Peter Richards says, because more customers were coming and going. He said, instinctively, everyone's like, if you got rid of free parking, our business will die. But that's wrong. Street parking is so ubiquitous that converting it feels like a loss. Firth says it is a powerful psychology that makes many resistant to the idea, adding, we value the loss of something much greater than the gain of something else. The patios, parklets, and bike lanes that took over street parking spaces during the pandemic has shown the possible uses of a city curb other than to store empty cars. Firth says, there's been this little space where we can demonstrate, first of all, the loss of the parking was maybe not as bad as people thought, and the gain of the patio was way better than people thought it would be. Maya Bendroor says converting space could also help cities move more efficiently and more sustainably. Cars traveling on a single 10-foot wide lane move about 1,600 people an hour in cities, whereas converting the same lane to a protected two-way bike lane, for instance, would allow 7,500 people to get around. She says a lane delineated for transit, whether for buses or trains, could move 8,000 people an hour, adding, if we were to use a lane which is a public space more efficiently, we would seek to use it for something that is healthier for people and for the air. Maya Bendroor says any efforts that help us shift away from driving and towards shared and active modes of transport, such as walking, biking, scooting, or public transport, are key to tackling the climate crisis. She says making systemic changes in the way we get around could help prevent an additional 1 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions a year by 2050, on top of those saved by electrifying vehicles. And as the time that we have left to limit climate change effectively dwindles, every ton of greenhouse gas emission that we don't emit counts.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the recent events which took place in Afghanistan. You know, 2-3 bomb attacks happened in the Friday prayers in the mosques, and the Shia minorities have been attacked, which resulted in the death of a large number of the faithful worshippers, you know, and it really saddens all the Muslim and the Shiite communities in the world. You know, what's happening is that now the world expects the Taliban, who is in power, in order to prevent the recurrence of such tragedies in Afghanistan and to punish the perpetrators of these, you know, attacks. But the case is that the Taliban itself used to do such actions before against the Shias, and now the question is how the Taliban and the Daesh, the ISIS, can bear each other in Afghanistan, because now the Daesh claims the responsibility for the bomb attacks and the Taliban is in power. Sayyid Murtaza, how they can manage this, and how do you think that Taliban can really change its behaviors against ISIS or Daesh?
Well, you know, Taliban's presence in Afghanistan since 2001, after the 9/11 attack on Twin Towers in America, they have carried out, they have planned, they have even recruited some of these suicide bombers. And they carried out the same attacks over the past 25 years. And now ISIS-K claims such a you know, brutal act, and they claim that they were responsible for these killings. Wantedly or unwantedly, Taliban is in power, and the international community expects Taliban to provide protection for and to all minority groups. So they cannot, I mean, Taliban cannot say that they are weak. They have just been in power for a very short time. They need time. They need support from the international community. Unfortunately, Taliban know very well that these suicide bombers have been trained, financed, and supported for a specific, killing operations across the country. So Taliban must come to understand that if they want to have a sustainable governance ruled by themselves, they must show their respect to the international community, I mean, human rights, the rights of minorities. Otherwise, they will face the same problem as they faced after the 9/11 attack in the year 2021. Yes. So Taliban must do whatever they can to provide protection by all means.
Yes.
So providing security and protection for minorities, it must be their first top priorities.
So what about the similarities of ideologies between ISIS and Taliban?
So we cannot ignore that the Taliban and ISIS-K and ISIS in general have the same roots.
Mm-hmm.
Both are somehow called Takfiri groups.
Yes.
And they are going to enjoy their similarities. Unfortunately, I'm very sorry to say this, that Taliban and Daesh have been considered the same by the Afghan nation.
Oh.
And on the other hand, we have international communities. Now neighboring countries to Afghanistan know Taliban as a terrorist group, and ISIS-K for sure is the same as
yes.
Taliban. So there is no big... I cannot actually draw a differentiation line between Taliban and ISIS-K ideologies.
Okay.
They have the same kind of ideologies, probably their means, their targets, and the way they treat other minorities might be different from time to time.
That's all right. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, what about you? I mean, Islamically speaking, from the point of religious point of view, or and the jurisprudential point of view, are ISIS and Taliban the same?
Well, obviously, their action shows that they're following the same ideology. And the things that we have seen through the history that were done by the Taliban towards the Afghan nation, yes. I don't want to really use the word minorities because, you know, when we talk about a country, for example, if a person, whether it's a black, white, Asian or anything, if he has the nationality of that country, he's the part of that country.
Yes.
So the main thing which we are missing here and which Taliban and other groups are missing in Afghanistan is to see Afghanistan as a country and the people who are living there as their own part. You know, this is a big thing which they're missing. If Taliban thinks every single Afghanistani to be like the person who's living there as an Afghan national,
yes.
then obviously they will not do such things.
That's
but
right.
Unfortunately, history has shown us that when the Taliban wasn't in power, they were doing the same actions
mm-hmm.
against the Afghan nation. So I don't want to use the minorities or
yes.
the names of the groups. Rather, I will use the word that the Afghan nation.
Yes.
So they did the same thing against the Afghan nation. Now when the Taliban is in power and Daesh has nowhere to go, and obviously the Americans through Turkey, even, you know, on the 14th of October, it was this statement by Putin, that Putin has said that the America has basically brought many Daesh groups into Afghanistan through Turkey. So it's according to their own, you know, sources,
yes.
which they have, the Russian sources. So they claimed that the Daesh groups have existence in the Afghanistan. So now when Taliban is in power, and if Daesh is doing such an activities in order to get the power from Taliban, obviously they are trained to take power of a country. Obviously, when they have their existence in the Syria and in the Iraq, it was to take power.
Yes.
Now when they're in Afghanistan, they will obviously strike for the same
yes.
aim,
okay.
for the same goal that they have.
That's right.
Now, jurisprudence, if you like, juristically, if we talk, there we can say like beliefs are the same. There is no change in them. The only change is that Taliban is now in power and it has responsibilities. It is answerable to the world because it wants the ruling or rulership of Afghanistan. It is aiming to rule over Afghanistan. So unfortunately, he has to back up from some of its,
yes.
you know, we can say like beliefs that they have. The way in Saudi Arabia, obviously, there are the Shias, but
yes.
they're in a hidden
yes.
situation. But Afghanistan's situation is changed.
Yes.
Now, juristically or like ideologically, they both are the same. Daesh is a bit extreme, we can say, like, if we want to, like, differentiate between both
yes.
of them, is the new version who were well-trained, who were trained by Americans and were imposed on Syria and, obviously, Iraq. And the your countries also, obviously, they backed this ISIS group.
Right.
So we don't see any differentiation between them, as brother
yes.
has said, like
although
the Afghan nation. Yes.
Unless they claim
the
that
only
they
thing
are different,
is,
okay?
Yeah, the only thing is there are two different groups.
Yes.
You know, within Daesh, we have seen in Syria and Iraq as well, that those, you know, within Daesh groups, there were different groups who wanted to rule, and they have their own caliphs.
Yes.
You know, and then they had fight amongst each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted, obviously, have control over other groups. The same thing is happening here now. But what I think is, I think Daesh is more in power than Taliban in Afghanistan because the way they are trained, the Taliban is not trained that way.
Really? Is it so, Said Mirza?
Because,
you
know,
that?
they found in Syria, they found
okay.
in Iraq, they were having, you know, the new weapons were given to them.
Yes.
Logistically, the training that they had, the weapons they had, the use of weapons, the ideologies which were given
yes.
to them. Because Afghan Taliban has existence only in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
If they were in other countries and then they were coming back to Afghanistan, that was another case. Whereas Daesh was in Iraq, it was in Syria, now it's in Afghanistan, they have their own existence in Pakistan and other countries
okay.
as well.
So
they have more
yeah.
experience.
Said Mirza, this is really a good question because Daesh has not been successful in Syria and in Iraq. and they have been evacuated because of the position of Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies over there in the region. Now, I think the Taliban governance might be a good chance for Daesh in order to find its presence again in the region in Afghanistan. Is it so?
Well, you know, Daesh, especially ISIS-K and Taliban, have no big difference. The only difference is the approach they choose to treat their targets. So I might disagree with some statements my brother made here.
Okay.
Many Taliban fighters, I can call them some Afghan nations, have been taken from Afghanistan through Saudi Arabia, and they have been sent to Yemen now, and some of the Afghans are still fighting in Yemen. So many Taliban soldiers have been trained outside Afghanistan, like ISIS-K. So Taliban and ISIS have some military similarities. They have been outside Afghanistan for many years. We know that Pakistan provided a very strong and good training camps for Taliban over the past 25 years. And Taliban, you know, have fought a very long war in Afghanistan. ISIS doesn't have such a you know, experience. Yes. In war. The biggest war that ISIS were directly involved was the war in Syria and Iraq. And we know that the Islamic actually coalition, including some countries around Syria, helped Syria to take out ISIS from Syria. And we know for sure that Taliban have been satisfied from their training camps, military assistance and financial assistance that was provided over the past 25 years by some countries.
That's
right. So I think Taliban is not very much different from ISIS. And ISIS-K soldiers in Afghanistan are not going to be very much as strong as the Taliban forces are. As my brother mentioned, Taliban fighters or soldiers are the Afghan nationals. They know very well the ground, and they are fully familiar with the geographical situations.
Yes.
Of the sites of.
Yes.
The country. But ISIS soldiers doesn't have such experience and knowledge.
Yes,
so right. ISIS K soldiers are going to suffer lack of such a knowledge that the Taliban forces have.
That's
so
right.
ISIS is not going to be as much active as Taliban forces were in the past. So I think let's see what happens, because now Taliban, as a terrorist group that was fighting.
Yes.
The ex-government, is in charge.
That's
and
right.
Now ISIS is going to face the Taliban as the ruling power in the country.
And
so I think this is a political game.
Yes.
To me, it's more of a political game, and I think in future... future will tell us more about their presence.
Just wanting to add,
okay.
Obviously there is a something missing in the statement.
Yes.
And the thing which we are missing is that when we're talking about ISIS, it does not mean that there are surely some foreigners coming into there. Obviously, when we're talking about Afghanistan, there are the Afghans part of ISIS who will be leading the ISIS in Afghanistan. Obviously, there are the Afghan nations who were the part of ISIS who went for, you know, war in Syria and Iraq.
Is it
they're
clear
they're
who
so
are, for example, these suicide
grounds,
numbers?
On these grounds, okay. They're equal. I don't see a change in between them. Like
okay.
They are. On top of that, obviously, ISIS is, we know that, backed by Americans.
Okay.
There's nothing hidden in it.
Okay.
You know, the logistical help, the maps, and the, you know, the intelligence help, which Daesh or the ISIS wants, America will definitely provide them all these things. So that's true. Like, I accept that the future will decide.
Okay.
What happened. But obviously, according to what we can see, like in the news and what's happening,
yes.
That was an analysis which was provided.
Okay. So the case is that really, as Brother Murtaza said, you know, the final victim of this crisis in Afghanistan are the Afghans, you know.
Yes.
20-year presence of a foreign power like U.S. had no fruits for them. You know, even the actors, actresses, and the singers that were affiliated with the U.S. ran away from the country in the last days, okay?
You know...
And from the other side, we have these, you know, extremist groups who got the power now in Afghanistan. Of course, they say we are changed, but we have to wait and we have to see what's happening in the future. But still, there is no clear situation in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, this Taliban is a kind of fundamentalist, extremist Islamic group.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to impose their strict Islamic order on the whole Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So because we know they are fundamentalists, they believe on extremism. So they are going to rule the country according to and by their own orders. So I think anyone who is believing in the modern style of living goes against the Taliban's ideologies and principles.
Yes.
So as you mentioned, the singers, musicians, artists, these type of people are leaving the country. Why? Because the ideologies Taliban are going to impose on the whole country is not actually deeply rooted in the Islamic principles
That's
and
right.
religion. So this is a kind of, it's a self-made version of the beliefs or Islamic beliefs that Taliban are following.
But the big question is that are these artistic groups belonging to the very Afghan culture or no? From one side, they belong to the American style of life. From the other side, to the extremist style of... Is there no middle ground between?
Well, let me quote on one of the Taliban's speaker in an interview with an Afghan TV.
Yes.
He said that, I will pay 30,000 to 40,000 Afghanis from my own pocket to singers if they don't sing.
Oh.
So what does that mean? It means that they are against all types of, entertainment.
That's all right.
Even if they are not against Islamic rules.
That's right.
So Taliban is a group that is going to impose their own ideologies instead of Islamic ideologies. This is a little bit, different.
That's right.
So their own understanding, their own interpretation of the Islamic ideologies principles is going to be imposed on people as what Islam says.
That's right.
And we know that this is not true.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen, for presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. We tried to discuss the recent crisis taking place in Afghanistan, and is really the Taliban changed? The answer might be, we have to wait. The on-the-spot answer is no, okay? But we have to wait and see what's happening in Afghanistan by the Taliban. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Al-Fi Amanullah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.